You're listening to News Talk 920, KPSI.
If we could talk to the animals, just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee.
This is Animals Today, featuring discussions about domestic pets, wild animals, and encouraging compassion and respect for all living creatures. Live from Palm Springs, here's Dr. Lori Kirshner.
Study every creature's language so I could speak to all of them on sight. If friends said, can he talk a crab or maybe pelican? You'd say like hell he can, and you'd be right. So if you just stop and think of it, there ain't no doubt of it. I'm gonna win a place in history. A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals. And they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to me.
Welcome to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Thanks for joining us. Hey, this is the first show of the second season. And to get things rolling, we have a very special guest who will be joining us today, Dr. Randall Lockwood. Randy is currently Senior Vice President of the ASPCA's Anti-Cruelty Field Services and widely recognized as one of the country's experts in animal abuse and especially the connection between animal abuse and human violence. We're going to talk about what goes on in the minds and environments of those who participate in dogfighting, animal fighting, and other sorts of abuse of animals. With the recently release of Michael Vick from prison and his reinstatement in the NFL, many of us have been talking about this a lot, and we'll get into Dr. Lockwood's perspective about it as well. First, a few words about this radio show, Animals Today. On Animals Today, we explore in depth the important issues related to animals, both domestic and wild. We're interested in our relationship with animals and their environment and our interactions with animals. I've interviewed whale protectors and district attorneys, filmmakers, authors. We've heard heartwarming stories like that of Wesley the owl. He was an injured barn owl who was raised from a baby and lived his whole life with author Stacey O'Brien. In addition, on Animals Today, we've exposed the ongoing cruelty of animals in circuses and in rodeos. By your emails and phone calls, I know we're on to something big here on Animals Today. I really believe there's this growing interest in animal concerns, and the once fringe is starting to become mainstream. We also love our pets on Animals Today, and so we cover a variety of programs related to domestic animals as well. We've had veterinarians who discuss common pet health issues like diabetes and arthritis, dental problems, pet allergies. We had an animal nutritional expert, and even Bob Vettieri. He's the president of the American Pet Products Association, to tell us about what's new and hot items to keep our pets happy and safe. I'm telling you, there's just no shortage of topics to explore here on this show. And I'm very proud to announce that Animals Today is now sponsored by Desert Paws. Desert Paws is a nonprofit organization whose main goal is to educate children and adults about important issues concerning animals and to promote the compassionate and respectful treatment of animals. An additional goal of Desert Paws is to build from the ground up a destination class learning and exploration center. Just imagine a very cool children's museum, but dedicated to all things related to animals and their environment and their interaction with people. So please visit desertpaws.org. That's desertpaws.org to learn about this and the other things that they are doing. And hey, if you like the show and want to support it, consider donating to Desert Paws. Okay, so we have been discussing and hearing about the Michael Vick dogfighting pro football story on the news and online and even in my household a lot these days. And I have to tell you right off that I am very disappointed in the NFL for letting this king of animal abuse slide back into the spotlight so easily. Actually, I'm really PO'd about this. When Vic was arrested or sentenced, what did you think was going to happen to him when he got out of prison? Well, I don't really know the workings of the NFL very well, but no way did I think he'd be back in uniform days after his release. After all, these were horrible things he did, not just the dog fighting, which is one of the most horrific forms of animal cruelty I can think of, but how about drowning and electrocuting and beating dogs to death? And he encouraged others to be involved in these activities. Now, I know all the objections to my point of view. He paid his time. He has the right to make a living. America loves a comeback story. He deserves a second chance. Blah, blah, blah. But for me, I just can't stomach that. Here is a guy who, in my opinion, has absolutely no human decency, who is only sad for getting caught, and whose apologies are so transparently scripted, it just makes me sick looking at his face, let alone be given back a national and international stage. Now, you guys might know that the Humane Society of the United States, led by Wayne Pacelli, is going to be teaming up with Vic on their ongoing anti-dog fighting campaign. But, you know, Wayne, I just have to disagree with you on this one. Vic clearly is just going through the motions. He doesn't care about the animals. He's not rehabilitated. I just don't think it's possible to make an effective role model out of this guy. Listen, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I don't think so. I do think, however, on one positive note in all this, that because of Mr. Vic and his unthinkable cruel crimes committed on these innocent animals, the public became more aware of dogfighting. Many people now know, maybe even for the first time, that dogfighting does exist, and it's everywhere, even in our own Coachella Valley. And this widespread awareness and the prevalence of this illegal activity is a good thing. And hopefully, because of this heightened awareness about the blood sport, more individuals will not hesitate to report to law enforcement, either witnessed or even suspected cases of animal cruelty or illegal animal fighting. Do you remember a few months ago, it was mentioned that when it was time for NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to consider Michael Vick's potential return to professional football, he'd be looking for evidence that Vick is truly sorry for his crime. Goodell stated, and I quote, "I think it's clear he paid a price, but to a large extent it's going to have to demonstrate to the larger community, not just to the NFL community and to me, that he has remorse for what he did and that he recognizes mistakes that he made." Well, last month, Roger Goodell conditionally restored Vic to the league after meeting with Vic and hearing his apology. I mean, what a ridiculous charade. The league obviously wanted him back and devised a way to make it happen without creating too much backlash against the NFL. The NFL wants its cash cow back in uniform. No offense to our cows intended. In his 60 Minutes interview, I don't know if you guys caught this, Vic also talked about his time in prison, saying he had time to think about what he had done, realizing what he had lost. He said that often he cried at night in his cell. Poor baby. You're crying all alone in your cell, Michael. Why were you crying, Michael? Why were you crying? Were you crying because you felt badly for the dogs when you brutally tortured and beaten them to death? Or were you crying because you blew a multi-million dollar contract, wrecked your fairy tale life, and was caught doing something you clearly enjoyed, which was torturing and abusing and killing dogs? The interviewer on 60 Minutes, James Brown, commented to Michael. He said, Michael, so for the cynics who will say, you know what, I don't know, Michael Vick might be more concerned about the fact that his career was hurt than the dogs were hurt, which I thought was an excellent remark made by James Brown. And Vick responded, quote, "I mean, football don't even matter." Oh, really, Mr. Convicted Felon? Football don't even matter? If it don't even matter, then why didn't you turn down NFL's offer? You can't fool me. You can't fool me with your scripted interview that you must have practiced over and over again, trying to convince the public that you feel remorse for what you did. You don't even act remorse well, Michael. Go practice some more. Maybe you'll convince a few more people that you're sorry for what you've done. You're sorry for getting caught. That's what you're sorry for. And I'm convinced that Michael Vick has absolutely no remorse for the suffering and terror and pain he's inflicted upon those innocent animals. Do I think that he's a changed man or has the capability of ever being a changed man? Heck no. A man that would not hesitate for years doing all those horrible things to dogs that you have read about and you've heard about, and now, after serving less than 2 years behind bars, he wants to hug and love and respect dogs? No way! Once a psychopath, always a psychopath. Okay, I'm going to sit back now, take a deep breath, and introduce our very special guest, who certainly can extend and expand this discussion and probably in a less excitable way. Dr. Randy Lockwood with the ASPCA is with us next. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. This is Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI. Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. I'm very happy to have with us on Animals Today Dr. Randall Lockwood. Dr. Lockwood's PhD is in psychology from Washington University, and for more than 25 years, he has worked with humane societies and law enforcement agencies, serving as an expert on the interactions between people and animals. Dr. Lockwood has testified in numerous trials involving cruelty to animals or the treatment of animals in the context of other crimes. He has published a number of books, many articles in scholarly and popular journals, and frequently provides training for law enforcement, social service, mental health, and veterinary professionals. Welcome, Dr. Lockwood.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Dr. Lockwood, I know it's such a huge field, but why don't you introduce the concept of the relationship between cruelty to animals and other violent acts done by people?
Sure. Well, this is not a new concept. Certainly, the idea that the way we treat animals is reflected in how we treat one another is part of most ethical treatments, a lot of religious writings and a lot of philosophical writings going back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. When Dr. Frank Ascione and I put together an edited volume of writings on this topic, we go back several hundred years to John Locke, drawing on articles from psychology, philosophy, anthropology, physiology, criminology, where professionals in many fields have really tried to confirm the basic notion that I think most of us have, that people who hurt animals are not nice people, or at least they are people who we need to be concerned about, who have the potential for violence against others. And I became interested in the subject of probably about 30 years ago as part of a general interest in relationships between people and animals. And I like to try to look at all possible relationships between people and animals, particularly pets, both good and bad. So I had been involved in some of the early research on health benefits of pets, and which have become almost cliched, that you know, pets do lower blood pressure and mm-hmm. help health and many other positive things. At the same time, I was concerned about public health implications, some of the negative public health problems associated with dangerous dogs and dog bites, and did research in that area. And then I had been very much involved, even from my college days, of doing humane education, volunteering with various humane groups, doing school programs, doing wildlife programs, was interested in how people in general and kids in particular become develop positive attitudes and positive relationships with animals. And the final part of that equation is looking at why and how people are cruel to animals and what the impact there is. So I've tried to understand all the dimensions of how people and pets in particular can interact. But
so, Dr. Lockwood, I'd love to get into a few of these things with you. How is animal abuse similar to violence against people and similar to domestic and child abuse? There must be many parallels, correct?
There are many, many parallels. And one of my concerns originally going back 30 years is that, you know, when you look back at the early days of animal protection organizations, in local humane societies, very often the person who was investigating cruelty to animals was also kind of the conscience of the community. Reading the log books of cruelty investigators from the turn of the century, they might try to catch a rabid dog. They might break up a fight between boys at a schoolyard. They might track down a deadbeat dad who'd run away from his family without leaving support. He might then rescue injured dogs. And what happened over the last 100 years or so was all those different societal systems for dealing with cruelty became separated into the categories of victims. So we have child protection agencies, we have domestic violence responders, we have elder abuse investigators, and animal cruelty. And often people were not making the connection that often it was the same perpetrator. So it really was about 25 or 30 years ago that people started looking at it from the standpoint of the offender rather than the victim, saying, mm-hmm. Who are these people? And that's when we started to see a high degree of overlap, that it is often the same people who are involved in child abuse, domestic violence, elder abuse, and animal cruelty. And that's when we started kind of looking at, well, what are the psychological roots? Where is this coming from? And often it is about power and control. Mm. That's one of the things that seems to unite the different forms of violence, that often the triggers for cruelty and abuse are related to the individual just feeling that he, and we're usually talking about he as an intentional cruelty offender, the triggers often involve him feeling that somehow he's not being respected, he's not in control, and seeking to gain control or maintain control over others through violence. And that's one of the things that does pull them together.
So, Dr. Lockwood, if you look at adult violent offenders as a group, are they more likely to have been animal abusers as youths?
There have been many studies, and actually a new one just came out this week looking at some of this, and repeatedly most of these studies do show that people with a history of interpersonal violence are much more likely to have a childhood history or early adult history of repeated acts of gratuitous animal cruelty, and might often involve other antisocial behaviors like and criminal behaviors like fire setting. Studies I've been involved in looking at, well, there are two ways you can do this. You can start out with a population of people who you know have been cruel to animals and then follow them for many years. And that's difficult to do, particularly going back a few years, because there weren't that many people being charged, and it is very hard to track people for 5 or 10 years. But that was done by the Massachusetts SPCA, beginning with data that was collected in the 1970s following close to 250 offenders. And what they found was that compared to people who were matched controls, meaning people the same age, sex, lived in the same neighborhood, same ethnic background, that compared to their matched controls, the animal abusers were about 5 times more likely to also be involved in other acts of interpersonal violence. About 4 times more likely to be involved in drug offenses. I think about two or three times more likely to be arrested drunk and disorderly. And you know, overall, there was a confirmation of this general picture of them as not nice, law-abiding people. What that particular study didn't clearly demonstrate was a progression that sometimes the crimes against animals had actually followed the crimes against people. So it's not necessarily a rehearsal or a progression. But we still think that that is one common pattern, particularly for young offenders. That study did not involve a lot of young kids. Then the other way you can try to gather this information is start out with a population of offenders already and then look backward in their life history and see what happened there. And some of the studies that fail to show a connection are those that simply look up the arrest records of people in jail and look for arrests for animal cruelty, and you don't find them very often if that's all you do.
If you're just tuning into the show, I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. You're listening to Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI. We're speaking to Dr. Randy Lockwood with the ASPCA. Dr. Lockwood, when a child grows up in a household with domestic abuse going on, what does it do to the psychology of the child?
Yeah, it's a very individual reaction, and we know that most violent offenders have come from backgrounds of abuse, but most abused children do not necessarily become violent offenders. So that's been one of the most interesting questions to us, is what is there for the folks who are exposed to violence and yet survive, gain strength? You know, so exposure to family violence can be very debilitating and create intergenerational violence, and that's a common result. But also likely is certainly many of the people that I meet who are in social services or in animal protection have come from backgrounds where they have experienced personal exposure to violence and basically have vowed not to let that happen to those in their care or their protection. So one of the things we are interested in is how can you overcome that background, and how can you empower victims to, in fact, not be victimizers, but be rescuers of those who might otherwise be victimized. And a lot of that has to do then with what resources are offered to them. Are there mentors? Sometimes all it takes is one caring person, whether it is a grandparent or a relative or a teacher or just someone in the community that has reached out and helped the victims of violence.
You describe four main elements that contribute to a person becoming an animal abuser. Can you please describe those elements?
Well, I think there is, again, this need for power and control. There is an exposure to violence. Sometimes another factor simply is actual intelligence and having the intellectual resources to see that there are options, there are other opportunities. Those are the kinds of things that are commonly there. That the other thing that is a warning sign or a danger sign is that if someone is gaining a sense of empowerment through the suffering of others, and it has no consequences for them other than to make them feel empowered, that's the particularly dangerous thing. That's, you know, the famous quote from Margaret Mead that the worst thing that can happen to a child is to violently kill an animal and get away with it.
Right.
It is the getting away with it that is the issue there, and is the common thread that we see in the childhood histories of a lot of violent offenders.
Right. Yeah. Right. Dr. Lockwood, so any advice for parents of an otherwise normal kid? Let's say throwing rocks at a stray cat versus throwing rocks at a disliked schoolmate. Should parents treat these situations differently?
Yeah, and I think they certainly have to be seen as red flags and cries for help. That the child who is seeking to again gain the sense of power by hurting something is sending a message that he feels out of control. He feels a need for control. The reality is that also sometimes it's a teachable moment. It depends also on the age of the kid. You know, I often see out at the Washington Mall, we have a large sprawling grassy area that attracts lots of pigeons, and it's a pretty common thing to see, you know, little kids chasing the pigeons to make them fly away.
Right.
Kids throw rocks to make them fly away, and then very interested in seeing how the parents react.
Exactly.
that and often it's the child that has absolutely, you know, no, we're he's learning for himself, oh, I throw rocks at something, I get a reaction out of them, and no one steps in and says that scares them, or how would you feel if things were big things were throwing rocks at you?
Yeah, good point.
That it's a teachable moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, in many ways, the kids that are left to their own devices to find a source of stimulation and empowerment and do so through causing fear and pain and suffering to animals, they're sort of like a, you know, the dog that's left chained by himself.
Yeah.
And as people go by, he lunges at the chain and growls and barks and responds aggressively, and the people run away. And because he's been unsupervised, he's basically taught himself that showing aggression gives me power and control.
Yeah.
And I often say to people, you don't need to teach a dog to become vicious. They're capable of teaching them themselves that if they're in an environment that is reinforcing that.
So true.
So we do have to take advantage of those opportunities to teach kids empathy and compassion and viewing animals as sentient creatures.
Wonderful point. Are there socioeconomic factors that influence the likelihood of animal abuse?
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, we have seen our violent offenders. It's sort of not unlike the demographics of domestic violence, and you know, some people look upon domestic violence as being something that's more associated with poverty and so on. And there's a little bit of a connection there, partly because the violence comes from a lack of a sense of lack of control and empowerment. But we certainly see many instances of child abuse, elder abuse, and domestic violence at all levels. The classic study I was involved in looking at how pets were treated in child-abusing families was actually done in Princeton, New Jersey area with essentially middle and upper middle class families, which were experiencing both child abuse and animal cruelty. So I think we certainly need to be careful about just, you know, saying, well, that's animal cruelty goes along with poverty. It certainly can be associated with other things, and one of which is going to be the lack of parental supervision. If you aren't engaged with your kids, if the kids aren't in school, if the kids are in schools where they're not, don't have a good mentoring relationship with teachers, if they don't have a community that is giving them some guidance, sure, there's greater opportunity for essentially teaching themselves to find sources of empowerment.
Dr. Lockwood, we need to go to a break. Actually, I want to squeeze in one question before our break here. What's going on in the heads of animal abusers? Certainly, impulse control and arousal issues are involved, but you have also presented data that brain function, as seen with PET scans and functional MRI, are abnormal.
That might be in some, and we have very little data from animal abusers, but we know from other violent offenders that often there are problems of impulse control, problems of frontal lobes, basically the parts of the brain that say, whoa, you might not want to do that. And that can be something that is inherent. That can be something that's the consequence of abuse. It can be a physiological problem. It can be related to drug use. There's so many potential interactions, but that's one thing that's rarely looked at. And with our very serious and violent repeat offenders, I often do recommend that we should have a complete neuropsychological workup, because you can't really fix the behavior until you've fixed the machinery underneath it.
We're going to continue our very informative discussion with Dr. Randy Lockwood. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. This is Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI. We're back with Dr. Randy Lockwood. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. We're speaking to Dr. Randy Lockwood with the ASPCA. We're speaking about the psychology of animal abuse and the psychology of the offenders of animal abuse and the strong connection between animal abuse and human violence. And Dr. Lockwood made the point very well that animal abuse, especially in children and young adults, it's really a warning sign. It's not just venting of emotion in a healthy individual. It's usually a warning sign that there's something else going on. And what we're going to talk about now, I'd like to speak about organized dogfighting, Dr. Lockwood. How common is organized dog fighting in the United States, and when and how do participants get involved?
Yeah, well, it's very common. I think we do see it in virtually every state and have had arrests in almost every state just in the last few years. We talk about a couple of different forms of dog fighting, the organized or professional or hobbyists that devote a lot of their time and money to this. And then what is definitely on the rise is the less organized street fighting, where we'll have two or three or four individuals getting involved in an impromptu fight, often in a schoolyard or abandoned building. That really seems to be on the rise and is seen in virtually every major city. And you know, often it, these days, that level of fighting is associated more with gang activity, with drug activity, with other neighborhood control issues. The more organized fighting, both cockfighting and dog fighting, has been around since pre-Civil War times and used to be more associated with rural or suburban America, and often was more common in the Southeast, but also found it somewhat in the Midwest, in Ohio and Missouri. How people get involved, again, it's like any other illegal enterprise for a variety of reasons. For some, it is the old-timers really did see it as a sport, and they did see the dogs as athletes and as an investment, and gave them bragging rights, but also income. And money is a major factor for dog fighting. There can be tens of thousands of dollars wagered in a single fight, and it's not unusual for authorities to find tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars when raiding a major dog fight. These days also it is about bragging rights, turf battles, and again the monetary basis of it has shifted a little bit in that we do see drugs involved with virtually every dogfight raid, and probably in about a fourth of the dogfight operations that are raided do result in the seizure of illegal weapons as well.
Yes.
So again, there's that general criminality that goes along with it.
Right.
And as before, not necessarily characteristic of any particular cultural group. I think one of the mistakes that that I've seen recently is people, certainly given the Michael Vick case and others, have talked about this being part of black or inner city culture, which simply is not an accurate reflection of, until fairly recently, it was very rare to find African Americans involved in dog fighting until about 10 or 15 years ago. It was pretty much a good old boy enterprise. But I think that started changing back in the mid-80s, partly with the rise of breed bans and pit bull bans, that when communities started defining pit bulls as outlaws, that provided the unintended consequence of giving people a very easy way to define themselves as outlaws. You get involved in dogfighting.
Now, you mentioned Michael Vick. I would like to bring him up. What specifically did he do? We know he was not just an ordinary participant. He was the ringleader, and he bankrolled the operation, correct?
Correct. And his actual conviction was for the conspiracy to organize the fight operations, not dogfighting itself. Dogfighting became a federal felony actually a month after he was arrested, so the tougher charge that could be levied against him at the time of his arrest was the conspiracy and trafficking, moving animals across state lines for purposes of fighting. And he fits in an unusual category in that the techniques that he and his colleagues were using, the way they were training animals, the kinds of animals they had on the site, and the way they were killing animals were what we see with street fighting. It was basically taking that street gang attitude, but applying it on a much larger scale, that he had 51 fighting dogs on his premises, and most street fighters might have two or three. So at that level, he was like a professional, but the professionals showed much more interest in bloodlines, much more consistent training stuff, training procedures. And if animals were not performing, they would usually be simply taken out and shot, not killed with the kind of violence and venom that was described in the indictments against Vic.
Oh, it's horrible.
And that's the kind of thing that we see, again, in street fights where animals are hung or electrocuted or bludgeoned or drowned. That's not something that we were traditionally seeing in mainstream, so to speak, dogfighting.
Yeah.
And that's what made the case, I think, particularly disturbing and particularly interesting to law enforcement.
Dr. Locke, would you care to speculate on what's going on in the mind of a wealthy star who runs a dogfighting operation? It just seems to me it's not just the cruelty involved, but personally reckless and risky.
Well, this is the big question that many people have raised specifically about Vic as someone who could have, who did have it all in terms of income and contacts, and yet his strongest motivation seemed to be staying true to his roots, and he had allegedly been involved with fighting dogs since pre-adolescence, since he was 8 or 9. And part of his problems was allegedly his inability to separate from the boys back home, that whether that's just the loyalty that he felt to the people who'd been with him through it all, to his entourage, but had not taken advantage of all the incredible opportunities available to him and had made many very bad decisions. And that's why I'm somewhat skeptical about the sincerity of his rehabilitation. We'll see, because he had so many other opportunities to do the right thing for the community, to do the right thing for the kids he claims that he wants to inspire, but really has not, I don't think, has in his statements that come from himself, that come out of his own mouth and not things that have been crafted for him by his attorneys, I've yet to see true evidence of empathy or compassion or realization of the harm he did to the animals.
Exactly. And do you think he just won't be an effective role model for kids like the Humane Society appears to believe?
He certainly will attract an audience, he'll attract a crowd, but whether or not he had certainly been effective in raising public awareness about the problems of dogfighting, so to that extent he has performed a service, but whether or not he can reliably speak. One of the things, in general, looking at working with young offenders, the kind of scared straight programs or people speaking out, those kind of one-shot deals, it's sort of like the one-shot humane education lecture where you go in the classroom, say, be nice to your animals and spay neuter them and then leave. That doesn't really affect permanent change. What you really want to do is work at systematic and systemic change, that rather than giving a lecture to a class of potential offenders, Vic should be pouring some of his money into programs that provide pro-social positive opportunities for kids, not just working with animals, but in general. Kids get diverted into dogfighting as a source of potential empowerment, as a source of money, because there aren't any other real options. For him, the option to him was sports. For a lot of kids, that's not an option. And, he should be spending his resources to see what else can he do in these communities to elevate kids out of these issues.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard before my introduction on this topic. I completely agree with you. I don't think he would be an effective role model. I don't think he feels remorse at all. All the interviews I've seen, at least on TV and on 60 Minutes, were just so obviously scripted, Dr. Lockwood. It was incredible. And I'm also very disgusted with the NFL for allowing him back in the league. Dr. Lockwood, what other sorts of animal fighting, like cockfighting? We have a couple minutes. I do want to talk about a couple of your books. Can you mention a few words about cockfighting? And how it relates to animal fighting?
Sure. And cockfighting is more difficult to get a lot of public sentiment against, although it's now illegal in every state, and as of this year for the first time. And what I find in dealing with cockfighters and dogfighters is many cockfighters really think dogfighters are scum of the earth, yet many dogfighters are also involved in cockfighting. You know, one of the differences is obviously dogs have a special role in our society. They are members of our families. And being involved in an activity that causes the pain and suffering and death of a lot of animals is totally inexcusable. It's harder to get sympathy for people involved in an activity involving animals that most people eat. And you know, I've had cockfighters say to me, my bird has a better chance in the pit than he would have with Colonel Sanders.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
And yet there still is pain and suffering.
Of course.
And there is a high degree of involvement in other illegal activities as well. There are drugs, there are guns, there are the same kinds of violent people that are drawn to both activities, and law enforcement has recognized that going to cockfights or dogfights is a good way to locate people who have outstanding warrants.
You authored the book Prosecuting Animal Cruelty for the National District Attorneys Association. What are the challenges in these cases, Dr. Lockwood? How do prosecutors develop the expertise to deal with animal cruelty cases?
Two aspects. One is first overcoming internal political pressure to drop a case because it's only an animal. That's not as big an issue, and partly what we have to our advantage is the fact that most prosecutors are elected officials and they must respond to the will of the public. The question I'm asked by them constantly is, why do I get 20,000 emails on a dog burning case and yet I get no inquiries about a child abduction case? And partly that's because the public feels that the animals don't have any other advocate, that they have to step forward. So overcoming the resistance to take this seriously, and that's changed now that our animal cruelty laws are so much tougher. When animal cruelty was at best a misdemeanor in most states, most prosecutors wouldn't want to expend the resources. You know, investigating and prosecuting dogfighting is as difficult as cracking a drug ring and as dangerous for the investigators. And yet, if it was just a misdemeanor where you might get 30 days in jail, there's very little incentive for law enforcement to move forward on that. Now that that is a federal felony as well as state felony in every state, there's much stronger incentive. So that's been a major improvement. And the other difficulty is that the animal cruelty cases are different, that the victims and the evidence are the same. The animal's body is both its evidence and the animal itself is a victim that must be cared for if still alive. And it's very important to have very good and accurate veterinary information, which is why we spend so much time training veterinarians to be active participants in animal cruelty investigation, and why we've launched a new program at University of Florida with a Center for Veterinary Forensics.
In the last 2 minutes or 1 minute, could you tell us about your book, Forensic Investigation of Animal Cruelty, A Guide for Veterinarian Law Enforcement Professionals? We would love to hear, maybe at a later show, have you bring you on again to talk about your forensic unit that you told me about earlier.
Yeah. Well, what we're basically now doing, now that crimes against animals are seen as serious crimes, we are bringing the resources that have become so popular in prosecuting crimes against people and building on forensic science. We have really tried very hard to learn as much as we can from our counterparts in human crime labs to study how we might use DNA, how we can use ballistics, how we can use blood stains and spatters. We have ASPCA staff that are trained to do grave excavations, as we did in the Michael Vick case, based on what we've learned from human medical examiners. We do blood stain analysis. We run DNA in cruelty cases, and you teach our investigators hopefully up-to-date techniques of forensic and crime scene investigation to bring that higher level of scientific certainty and expertise to investigating and prosecuting animal cruelty.
Very good. And I should just mention a previous book of yours, which was Cruelty to Animals and Interpersonal Violence, Readings in Research and Application. Dr. Randy Lockwood with the ASPCA, thank you so much for being here with us on Animals Today. Very informative.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Well, that was very interesting, very informative. Wanted to summarize all the really important points here to the Michael Vick case and psychology of dogfighting and the interconnection between animal abuse and human violence. Very interesting. So glad you were able to join us here on Animals Today. This is the first show of the second season. And, you know, I should also mention that at Animals Today, many of these animal-related topics are discussed, or the discussion continues, I should say, on Facebook. If you're a Facebook person, please visit Animals Today or go to our website, animalstodayradio.com. Thanks again for joining us. Stay tuned next Sunday, 8 o'clock in the morning. We'll have another wonderful show on Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirsch, and I want to thank you for tuning in, and feel free to email me suggestions or comments about the show, drlori@animalstodayradio.com. That's drlori@animalstodayradio.com, or just log on to the website, animalstodayradio.com. Animals Today is sponsored by Desert Paws. Please visit their website, desertpaws.org. This informative and educational show about important issues related to animals and the environment is possible with your financial support. If you care to donate, please do so to Desert Paws. This is Dr. Lori Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.